Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, August 18, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss the allocation of the costs of discovery. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two panelists, two experts, to today's conversation. We'll hear first from Alex R. Dahl. He's a shareholder at Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, and Schreck, and he also works with the Lawyers for Civil Justice. We'll hear then from Professor A. Benjamin Spencer. He's the Earl K. Shaw Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. Each of them has some 8 to 10 minutes to make their opening remarks. Then we'll have a little bit of back and forth, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions. So please do be thinking of those questions for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Alex Dahl, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you for having me on these excellent teleforum Federalist Society events that you put together. They're great, and it's a privilege to be on with Professor Spencer as well. I would like to start on this topic with what I hope is some common ground. And the common ground is that the purpose of discovery in civil litigation is to obtain the information necessary for the fact finder to resolve the legal issues in the lawsuit. And by that, I mean the claims and defenses in the case. I also hope that there's understanding here that discovery can be expensive and that the expense of discovery can thwart the purposes of civil justice by pricing people out of the ability to obtain judicial resolution of their claims and defenses. My view is that the FRCP, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, should incentivize pursuit of discovery at the lowest cost and the least burdensome manner to obtain the evidence necessary for a merits-based resolution by the finder of fact. And I think that this is fundamental to the judicial system and, in fact, is incorporated into Rule 1, which has a guiding principle of just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of all cases. I'll next go to an observation about this topic, and my observation is that whenever the topic of requester pays, the idea that the person making the discovery request should pay for some or all of the cost of that request, comes up, it is very often met with a reaction that the purpose of this idea is to block people from the court. And I just want to start off by saying that nothing can be further from the truth, for my opinion and for the organization I work with. The organization Lawyers for Civil Justice is comprised of entities that are plaintiffs and defendants and are interested in fairness in the civil justice system and not unbalanced in any way, but for a balanced judicial system. Let me go next to the history of why it is that there is a tradition in our American legal culture that the producer bears the expense of discovery rather than the requester. And this is entirely an accident. The accident is that when the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure were first written in 1938, the topic never even came up about who should pay for discovery. And the reason really has more to do with technology and economics than law, and that is that at the time, discovery didn't really cost much because there wasn't even photocopying or huge, vast stores of data like there are today. So discovery in civil litigation really meant lawyers looking into the files of the adversaries and perhaps marking what they wanted to use as exhibits. The costs of photocopying and then of electronic data retrieval have led this to be a real problem, where the costs of discovery are very important to whether people can get resolution of their legal rights in our civil justice system. This is where we get to the so-called American rule, which I believe is misunderstood. The American rule is supposed to state that each party bears its own costs, expenses, in litigation. Now, cost is a term of art in litigation, as you all know, so I'll try to refrain from using it. But when I say cost, I mean the big term, expenses, rather than the kinds of costs that we're more acquainted with in litigation. The American rule is opposed to what's known as the English rule, which is essentially loser pays. And the idea of the English rule is that if you are brought to court on an allegation of breach of contract, say, and are found that you did not breach the contract, you shouldn't have to pay for the cost of that litigation. So if you prevail, there was no contract breach, then the other side pays your expenses so that you are whole after going through litigation. And that's different in the American system. If you prevail at trial, you pay you still pay those expenses. But here's where I'm saying that I think the American rule is misunderstood, is that it's not winner or loser pays. As it's stated, I don't think it's even each party bears its own expenses. What the American rule really means today is each party bears the other side's expenses, regardless of who wins the case. And that's why I think that we really don't follow the American rule as it's described, and I think that that should change. I think that if the rules of civil procedure did not exist and they were being written today with the current environment, that there would certainly be a rule that contemplates the allocation of costs and that would incorporate some form of requester pays. The reason I say that is that requester pays comports with the most basic ideas of economic theory. And you don't have to even believe in much economic theory to understand this. It's a very simple principle that exists in all markets that we're used to, which is that the requester of goods or services is the one who decides what they're worth. And, you know, every day we do this. Do you want a particular meal or a side dish or to upgrade your airline seat or to have an optional feature in a car you're buying or something like that? That's always up to the requester. And the underlying idea of that is that the requester, the person who is asking for the good or service, is always in the best position to know whether that cost is worth it to them. What we have in our legal system is not that. It is we ask essentially judges to decide whether a particular kind of discovery or type of discovery or batch of discovery is worth the cost to one side, even though it's paid for by the other side. I think this is like going to a restaurant where you don't pay for your food, but you don't decide whether you get it or not. Somebody else, a third party, decides whether it's worth it to you to have a particular side dish, and that you don't make that decision, they do, and very often don't have all the facts of the case. Now, this dynamic is particularly true when not only is it a question of whether the discovery is worth the price that it costs, but also, of course, you have this dynamic in litigation that the other side is somebody that you disagree with or are mad at or however you want to characterize it. And so there is this inherent part of our system where the more you request, the more pressure it puts on the opposing party. And this is an inherent and very damaging part of our system, that economic pressure is being used to achieve results in our civil justice system that are not merits-based. The purpose of the economic pressure is to have determinations that are based on something other than the legal merits. And what happens because of the cost of discovery and this impositional cost of discovery is that people decide not to bring claims or defenses that they have the judicial right to do, or they settle compromise claims that they think that they are correct about but can't bear the cost, or they go outside of courts for alternative dispute resolution, or in some cases choosing other countries as the forum for their disputes. I want to wrap up here because it's almost 10 minutes in, but let me, as a final point, say that there is enormous practicality to a requester pays rule where that rule has, of course, sufficient protections to ensure access for justice, because requester pays is a self-executing rule. It has the intended effect, regardless of who the judge is, whether that judge is an active case manager or not, and it doesn't depend on judicial involvement or judicial resources. It frees the judiciary up to make other more important decisions, and so it's a very practical way to make litigation efficient. Let me stop there and turn over to Professor Spencer.
Professor Spencer, go right ahead.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for having this forum. This is a great concept. I think it's a valuable contribution to have a place where people can discuss these things rationally. And I want to thank Alex for that really wonderful, I think, an insightful overview of the issue. I came to this topic as an academic, really with no particular axe to grind, not advocating on either side. And it's just when I was looking at some of the different things that the Rules Committee was considering and some of the comments that were made in the last round of amendments, I picked up on this suggestion that the committee consider moving towards requester pays. And I thought, that's an intriguing idea. Let me look a bit further at what some of the arguments are in favor of that and see if I can evaluate that to come up with my own conclusions about what I think about moving to a requester pays model. So I approached it with a pretty open mind. And I think a good starting point for me is certainly recognizing the place that this proposal comes from, which, as Alex alluded to, is at least the notion or the belief that the discovery system is broken and that it's subject to abuse because it potentially or has the potential to permit requesters, principally plaintiffs, to impose costs on their adversaries through discovery in a manner that might coerce settlements for claims that don't have any merit. I think that's a legitimate concern to have, and that by not putting the cost of discovery request on the party requesting it, that can be a possible contributor to making the cost of discovery higher in absolute terms or higher than reasonable. So those are some things that I wanted to explore and I wanted to think about would a requester pays approach be the solution to some of those issues. One other argument that I saw in the literature and some of the commentary that was made by proponents of moving to requester pays was a constitutional argument, and I'm not going to get into that in my opening remarks because that wasn't brought up thus far in the conversation. But if there's anybody on the call who's interested in the constitutional argument, that's something that I have looked at as well and have come to the conclusion that there really is no merit to that constitutional argument. So I'd be happy to elaborate on that further in the Q&A period. But I'll focus the remainder of my opening remarks on the policy argument in favor of requester pays. One thing to understand is the current, make sure that everybody is on the same page in terms of understanding what the current system is. And it is true that once a request is propounded by a requester, assuming that the producer ultimately has to respond to that, the producer is going to bear the costs associated with retrieval and production and reproduction of the material. The rules do, particularly more forcefully after the 2015 amendments, require that those requests be limited to information that's relevant to a claim or defense that has been raised in the action. That's a bit narrower than used to be. You would have access to subject matter discovery, and that's no longer provided for in the rules as of last December. So the requests have to be relevant to a claim or defense. And keep in mind, these are claims or defenses that have survived the Supreme Court's recent articulation of a pleading standard under the Twombly and Iqbal cases, where if you aren't able to, in your complaint, present facts that show a plausible entitlement to relief as opposed to a speculative entitlement to relief, you're not going to get past the motion to dismiss stage. So you've got claims that have survived this Twombly-Iqbal pleading standard, and the requesters have to make requests, or at least the only the requests that will be responded to are those that are relevant to those claims or defenses that have gotten through that standard. The next thing to understand is that once the requester pays, they don't have carte blanche on being able to force or require the producing party to produce whatever they've requested. The producer is then given under the rules the opportunity to object. And they can object on many grounds, principally on the grounds of relevance, that the information sought is not relevant to a claim or defense. And now more prominently in the federal rules, they can object to the proportionality and burden associated with the request. And if the costs associated with the request are not proportionate to the needs of the case or what's at stake in the litigation, that is a sufficient grounds for producing parties to object. And then finally, the courts have now more explicitly the authority to order cost shifting in response to producer arguments in with respect to the burdens associated with production. And if the case is made, the judge can require the requesting party to pay some or all of those discovery costs. So it's important to be clear-eyed about the system that we're dealing with, and it's not necessarily the requester has absolute authority to impose without any restraint costs on the producing party. But there is a system that cabins and constrains what those requests, what requests will be deemed legitimate and responded to. The next thing I think it's important to understand is to put the issue of discovery cost and abuse in proper perspective. The most recent empirical study that I'm familiar with, and there may be more recent studies, but I am not aware of them, it comes from the Federal Judicial Center. I think it was a little over 5 years ago. And this was a research that they presented at a conference held by the Rules Committee at Duke University that I was in attendance for this presentation. And this empirical study found, which was to the surprise of many, if not all, in attendance, that there actually is no discovery in 40% of the civil cases in the federal system. That's 40% of the cases. And in another substantial additional percentage, discovery was limited to less than 3 hours of discovery. The study revealed that the median cost of litigation for defendants was $20,000, including attorney's fees. And it was only at the 95th percentile of cases did reported costs reach $280,000 for plaintiffs and $300,000 for defendants. And so one point that comes out of understanding that profile of discovery is that it's very important not to paint a broad brush over all of civil discovery and to talk about discovery abuse writ large. There is discovery abuse, no doubt, although it's hard within those numbers to determine what portion of those expenses were related to discovery requests that were unreasonable. But it is not appropriate to pretend that the discovery system overall or on the whole is broken, out of control, overly costly. The numbers just don't bear that out. Now, that said, that doesn't mean discovery costs and abuse is not a problem and is not a relevant issue that needs to be addressed. There are certainly a percentage of cases, perhaps in that fifth 5% area that we see, where this is a real problem. And for those batch of cases, it is important for us to talk about whether it would make sense to have a different approach to discovery cost allocation in those cases. But one of my difficulties with proposals that seek to change the federal rules is that they make changes to the rules for all cases. And I don't think it's a sensible approach to change the rules for all cases when in 95% of the cases, if not more, this is not an issue. I would like to focus on those percentage of the cases where it is an issue and then come up with a more rational approach. And that's something that I'm going to suggest. And so looking at the requester pays model or proposal specifically, one thing to ask is what would be the impact on the quality of claims that enter the system. One fear is that there are some less than meritorious or even frivolous claims that enter the system and gain access to discovery, although as I mentioned earlier, the heightened pleading standard should take care of some percentage of those claims. What impact would a requester pays model have on claim quality? If you raise the cost of litigation, inevitably that's going to decrease the number of claims that enter the system. But there's really no way to tell which kind of claims are we deterring. Are we deterring frivolous claims? Are we deterring meritorious claims? We're probably deterring some of both. We don't know if we're going to be over-deterring frivolous claims by moving to a requester-pay system or not. So that's something that is a little disconcerting. That doesn't mean do nothing. That doesn't mean the status quo is preferable. But that's something to think about, that if we raise the cost and put it on the requester, then that will reduce the number of claims. That can be a good thing for some claims that should have never come into the system to begin with. But it can also be a bad thing for meritorious claims that might never get brought. Another impact to consider is what would be the impact on the cost of discovery itself, the number of requests made by litigants, or the usefulness of information that you get. And rules that place the cost on requesters could certainly result in more appropriately narrow requests, but they could also result in unduly narrow requests that leave probative and needed information on the table. So I think it would be a fruitful area for further research to figure out precisely what the impact might be, because if we have litigants who need particular information but aren't in a position to pay for that, then we're not going to get to the goal that we all agree is a resolution of the case on the merits. You can only resolve the case on the merits if you have the information produced that shows what the merits are. So that's something to consider as well. So ultimately, you know, having free discovery for requesters, that's not necessarily the right answer, which is can be the status quo to some extent, because it doesn't incentivize requesters to make their requests reasonable and does to some extent empower them to impose costs on their adversaries in tactical ways that might force settlements of cases that should not be settled in that way. But I would say that a flat requester pays rule is not good either because of the harm potentially to legitimate claims and the equally perverse incentive that producers would then have to drive up production costs and to maintain information in costly to recover formats or locations. So I don't think either of those extremes are really the solution, particularly if you're revising the rules in that direction for all cases. So what I propose, because I agree there are some issues with the current system in some cases, is that you bring back judicial pre-screening of discovery requests. This was the system prior to the amendment of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure in 1970. You couldn't just propound a request on your adversary. You had to propound that request on the judge, and you had to demonstrate good cause, and if the judge saw that there was good cause for that request, it would then go to the producer who would have to respond. So if you brought the judge back into the system ex ante so that these requests would be screened by the judge ahead of time, I think that would go a long way towards chastening unreasonable or exorbitant requests. It's easy to make a request when it's just your opponent, and you know based on the tradition that your opponent in most cases is not going to go to the judge to challenge that request. But it's another thing if you have to put that request in front of the judge. It's going to have to pass the straight face test, and you're going to have to be able to defend that request. So I think bringing back the judge in the discovery process before the request, so they are being screened ex ante, would be a good way to go. Another way I think would be good to go is to look more into post hoc cost shifting, and this is after the case is over. And so if you have a producer who in the end has prevailed in the litigation, I think they have a legitimate claim for recouping some of those costs. They can currently recoup costs under Rule 54, but as Alex mentioned, costs are pretty narrowly understood and currently don't encompass all of the discovery expenses. And so I would be supportive of a redefinition of costs that would expand that definition, which is found in 28 U.S.C. Section 1920. I would support expanding the definition of costs to include these discovery expenses that might be able to be recouped on the back end. There are some issues with that that I won't go into, so that's not necessarily a slam dunk, but I think that might be another way to get some of the right incentives and be more strategic and targeted with where we are placing these costs in the cases where they actually matter, as opposed to a rule that addresses shifting costs to requesters in all cases. I don't think that's the way to go. I have some other thoughts. I do apologize for going over the guideline time period, and I look forward to your questions.
Very good. We've got a lot on the table here. I do want to give Alexander Dahl an opportunity to respond. Before we do that, let people begin to queue up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone to indicate you have a question. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. As I mentioned, there is a lot being discussed here. This is a fascinating issue, very interesting. But I'm going to start by giving Alexander Dahl a minute or two to respond.
Thank you, Dean, and thank you, Professor Spencer. That was an exceptional argument and very well done. I'm going to touch on just a couple of points very briefly because I'm eager to hear questions from the audience. I am going to agree with your point that the cases of abusive discovery are not the main are not the majority of cases in the federal system anyway. The abusive cases are a subset of that. But my point is that determining whether discovery is worth the burden that it is imposing is important in every case, even cases where that don't hit those kind of markers that the federal courts examine to see when litigation is kind of run over the banks. And usually that's about ancillary litigation, fighting about the scope of discovery. And to that point, because it's always important to know whether discovery is worth the burden, the point of the requester pays rule means that you get, as I mentioned before, the party in the best position to know what is worth it makes the decision. And I think that when you talk about that there are judicial limitations to the scope of discovery, a requester doesn't automatically get everything they request, what you're talking about is that somebody else has to make that decision, the judge, and a requester pays rule adds to that the idea that the person is asking is willing to pay some or all of that cost, and that changes the dynamic profoundly. Finally, to your point about bringing back judicial pre-screening, I very much appreciate this point. There are a lot of really great judges, federal and state, who do a great job of case management, and there are others who don't. But the problem really is that judges aren't always in the best position to know about the case and the issues and the information. And again, the idea that putting the party who's in the best position to know whether the discovery is worth it to their case as the decision maker, I think is helpful. My overall point here is that confidence in the judicial system is, of course, fundamental to the survival and the role of the judiciary, and that is undermined when people see civil justice as too costly to be available, and where you have to pay for things that are unimportant or irrelevant to the case. And the requester pays rule would go a long way toward giving people more confidence in the judicial system that it's worth the cost, and they're not going to end up just paying for lots of discovery that doesn't have anything to do with the case. And ask yourself this question: why are so many Americans afraid of being sued, even if they know it had no merit? And the reason is because everyone understands that being involved in litigation, even if you're vindicated, is a very costly and burdensome process. I think that sort of is a good example of what we're talking about. Let me stop there because I'm eager to have a question.
Terrific. Professor Spencer, we've got four questions to begin with on the call here. Can we move right to those questions now, or do you want to take 60 seconds?
Please.
Okay.
Please.
Let's take our first call of the day.
Yes, good day. It's David Emerson, society member here in Berkeley, California. I didn't hear much discussion at all about class actions and discovery in class actions. My question to both of the speakers, and this comes from my own background, being on the receiving end of both securities class action complaints and consumer class action complaints, is that there need to be some kind of a variance from the positions you're advocating for these types of cases. Because the dynamics are quite different. Often, in fact, almost always, the plaintiff's counsel is performing services on a completely contingent fee basis, and their compensation is largely calculated on a lodestar method of hours and time, and their hours and time often have to do almost, you know, very substantially with reviewing document production as a result of discovery. So there's the incentive is to create a large burden on the defendant, and then to also create a large number of hours for the plaintiff's counsel so that their compensation is rich. And do you see that the discovery process, as you view it, needs to be to accommodate this type of dynamic to improve it?
Who wants to take a shot at that one?
I guess I can start. This is Professor Spencer. I don't have strong feelings about that. I think what you say makes a lot of sense. I don't know that I can think of how the system should be adjusted to address that. I don't know if you're thinking that maybe requester pays would push back a bit against that. And that could be true. I'm just thinking out loud here. If a class action attorney had to bear the expense of the discovery that he or she requested, I don't know if that drives up their costs to the extent that their settlement number has to go up or that they stay in the case longer than they need to recoup those costs. And maybe that doesn't, what I just said, doesn't make any sense. So I don't really have any good thoughts in response to that. I think that is a real issue. And if there were a way to deal with the rules in a way that deals with that, that would be good. Maybe part of the problem is the lodestar method, or maybe you would need to look into when the judge is evaluating the cost, or when judges do this generally, they should discount some of that fluff that the attorney is putting in when they are reporting their hours, and that might disincentivize attorneys from doing that. But that would take a lot of judges moving in that direction over time.
This is Dean. Let me ask Professor Spencer a follow-up question, if I could, on class actions in particular. Are they disproportionately present in that 5% of cases you mentioned in the study, or did this study distinguish between class actions and non-class actions? That is, are they more subject to higher discovery costs? And then two, is it your sense, or do you have a sense whether or not class actions are more subject to fall into the category of abuse of discovery?
So the numbers, as far as I'm aware, did not distinguish class actions. I wouldn't be surprised if you found class actions in there. That said, class actions, the rate at which class actions are certified is not that high. And, you know, they have to get past the certification threshold to even get into the realm of discovery. And so, you know, with your ordinary case, you have the Twombly-Iqbal threshold. Well, with class actions, you've got that additional certification threshold. And that takes care of a large number of cases, of course, not all of them. But once a class action does get into discovery, I would imagine that the cost would be higher than the run-of-the-mill or even the median. As far as abuse goes, that I really can't speak to what extent you would find abuse of discovery in class actions versus your ordinary case. Just not sure.
Alexander Dahl, anything on these points?
Sure. You know, the question is interesting because the questioner says that there are two dynamics that are common in these class action cases, the incentive to increase the burden on the defendant and the incentive to increase the hours of review by the class counsel. I think that both of those are what we're talking about here when we as something that the requester pays rule is very helpful to, because when you add into the equation of that the requester pays some or all of the cost of discovery, they have to be a lot more thoughtful about what is it worth to have that information. How much, you know, what? Because those are just about litigation dynamics rather than the facts, the information that's needed for the finder of fact to make a decision about the case. So I think that to your question, do class actions need special rules? that a requester pays rule would work very well in this kind of case to minimize the dynamics that you're asking about here, and focus the parties more quickly on the merits of the case.
I'll just jump in. One more thought I had is, I mean, my general understanding of contingency fee-based practice or lawyers who aren't being financed by their clients is that because they're financing the litigation themselves until they can secure some sort of recovery, that they typically have an incentive to minimize their own costs or at least to minimize how deep into the hole they get with the case. So I'm not sure it would be rational for a class action plaintiff's attorney to drive up his own costs in terms of the time spent reviewing information that's not tied to trying to find useful information. So it would be hard for me to imagine a class action attorney going beyond and saying, well, I want to spend an additional X number of hours on reviewing useless documents so that I can have a large number of hours to report on the back end. I mean, I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but it would be hard for me to see that particular phenomenon with it being a major issue.
Very good. Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got three questions pending and about 20 minutes left. Before we go to the next question, let our callers know that tomorrow at noon we'll be discussing the international legal implications of the island building and expanding by China in Southeast Asia. That's a Teleform conference call we'll host at this same number tomorrow at noon Eastern Time. We now have five questions pending, so let's continue apace.
I apologize if this subject has come up before. I joined the call late. But I wonder, given the influence of the trial bar, how realistic is it that a user pay rule could be adopted? I mean, I'd welcome anything to cut down the abuse of the discovery process, but how realistic are we about, you know, the chances of something like this being actually adopted?
May I comment on that? This is Professor Spencer.
Please go right ahead.
Alex mentioned at the outset that the Rules Committee has taken this issue off their agenda, so they have discussed it and at least at this time decided not to move forward with something like this. And so I think proponents' strategy may be or may have to be, at least in the short term, seeking some sort of intervention by Congress. And Congress would have the authority to change the rule as they saw fit if they wanted to. And I think there's been some congressional testimony or hearings on the topic at some point. And so that might be an avenue for this to happen. Of course, anything that involves Congress and divided government becomes less likely. I think it would take some synchronization between Congress and the president for anything to happen on that front. So I doubt that there would be a way for this to happen in Congress unless you had the parties who were in favor of this controlling both the Congress and the presidency. And then as far as the rulemakers go, it's been tabled for now. Maybe it could make a comeback in the future if there's more data showing that there's a real issue that the committee needs to address. But that's just my thoughts on that.
Alexander Dahl?
Let me jump in there. Professor Spencer, of course, is exactly correct. The committee had earlier announced that they were going to look at requester pays rules, but ended up taking it off the agenda without working on it. Let me give you the case for some optimism, however. The 2015 amendments to the Rules of Civil Procedure include two important pieces that are related to this. First of all, the proportionality standard that is now part of 26B, the scope of discovery, is all about whether discovery is proportional to the case, and more specifically, has the test of proportionality includes not only the party's relative access to information, but importantly, the last phrase, whether the burden or expense of the proposed discovery outweighs its likely benefit. There is also a provision in 26C that Professor Spencer mentioned earlier as well, that specifically expressly allows courts to allocate costs when to control the burdens of discovery. I think that the combination of those two rule changes almost has to raise this question more often in litigation, because the rules require this kind of review, and increasingly the question should be asked. You know, there's a discovery request. You've already had some discovery. You're now asking for more. Would you still want the discovery if you had to pay some or part of that tab? It seems like a very logical question that judges would want to know. Like, what are we doing here? How important is this information to you? So I think that the discussion will increase, and that might lead the rule writers in the committee at some point to take up the topic again. There's also some new thought along these lines. I think that the law and economics school of thought has contributed so profoundly to many areas of law, not yet to discovery, but there is some new thinking about putting these kind of basic economic ideas into practice to confront what is obviously a very big problem, change in the litigation system, culture. You know, in the last, what has been 15 years or so, a rise of an entirely new multi-billion-dollar industry called e-discovery that didn't exist before is a good indicator that these kind of questions need to be asked.
We've got just over 10 minutes, four questions pending, so I'm going to ask our callers to be as succinct as possible with their questions. Let's go to our next caller.
Hello, my name is Shmuel Klein. I'm actually a plaintiff's litigator, so this will kind of maybe balance Mr. Emerson and Mr. Dahl's comments. When Mr. Dahl began his presentation, he cited the 1930s, and you go and look at, I'm not that old, but I understand he could go and look at the your adversary's file. But nowadays, I think now that we're in the 21st century, and I had one case where I got CDs of digitally processed documents, and Mr. Dahl also commented about e-discovery, and now that the cost of discovery has gone down, and I don't think the sky is falling on the costs of litigation. The cost of discovery. I remember cases where I used to get reams and reams and cases of paper, and as recently as last week, I got two CDs which had those reams and reams of paper, which cost the defense counsel very little to transfer onto a CD. And I'd just like to hear the panel's comment. I think that the purpose, I believe, of the rule changes address the cost of discovery, that there is this allocation. I fear that placing the request or pay rule would chill litigation, especially for consumer cases that I do. The cost would absolutely overwhelm a consumer attorney, whereas the large defense counsels have hordes of staff and resources, financial and otherwise, to defend those cases. So like
who wants to take a first shot at that? Who wants to take a first shot at that? And my understanding, this is Dean, by the way. I'd ask you in your response to address what I thought were some of the biggest costs of discovery, and that's the document review. That is, regardless of how many papers you don't have to photocopy, somebody's got to review them to see if they're responsive, if they're complete, if they're attorney-client privileged. But, gentlemen, who wants to take a first shot at that?
Well, let me start with that one. Mr. Klein, I'm so glad to hear from someone who says that the discovery costs are going down. That's good news. I'm glad that, sure, you know, that the theory of technological progress should mean that's true. But I do think that that is a very, very unusual experience today. One of the things that the Rules Committee had before it when it began looking at what became the 2015 amendments, started looking at 2010, were a couple of studies. The Association of Corporate Counsel did a study that was actually administered by the group called IELTS, the Institute for Advancement of American Legal System in Colorado. That study found that 80% of chief legal officers or general counsels disagree with the statement that outcomes are driven more by the merits of the case than by litigation costs. Over 70% of chief legal officers said that parties overuse permitted discovery procedures by going beyond what is necessary for their case, and 97% of the respondents said that litigation is too expensive. So there is an overwhelming view in stakeholders of our civil justice system that the price is just too high. Another fact from a NERA study comparing our system to major European countries found that our costs were 2.6 times what they are for equivalent litigation in those countries. So I think there really is a problem that there are people getting priced out and whose view, as I mentioned, of the view of the judiciary is that it is often not a place where you could go for a speedy, just, and efficient resolution of your legal rights. So I think that even though we're talking about abusive discovery as a subset of cases, and I hope by and large Mr. Klein's experience is more like most people's, but I'm afraid not.
Let's get another question on the table here. We've still got three questions pending, less than 10 minutes. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, my name is Arthur Schultz. I've defended corporate clients in environmental matters, and now I represent ordinary folks against the government. And the playing fields are uniquely different. The corporate clients have staff, and producing documents, at least in my experience, is normally part of the process. They have recovery systems, et cetera. For my individual clients, trying to get the discovery against the government has been an entirely different matter. The government has, in my experience, has been very reluctant. I've had a lot of difficulty, and I think making the requester pay would discourage a lot of people from seeking to vindicate rights, particularly if you're low or you don't have a lot of financial capital behind you or some public interest organization who can bankroll you. And I'll leave it at that.
Any response to that from our expert?
This is Professor Spencer. I would agree that making the requester pay will deter, as I mentioned earlier. It's unclear, you know, it will deter legitimate claims. It will also deter some illegitimate claims. And so that's why I'm more in favor of a calibrated response that on a case-by-case basis can deal with the cost-bearing issue as opposed to the blunt instrument that just does it across the entire system.
I would like to add that I'm in favor of modifying the requester pays to make sure that there is access to justice. But since you brought up cases against the government, let me float this idea for you. You know, FOIA is a system of the ability of people to get information for the government that I think is widely understood to be and a good example of transparency in our government, but you must know from your work, the way that it works is that you submit a request to the government, and they write back, and they say, this is what we understand the scope of your request is, and this is what it's going to cost you if you want the information. It is a request-or-pay system with modifications. There are ways to get FOIA information for free if you can't pay. And I think that what we ought to be doing as lawyers who are interested in improving our judicial system is to be thinking about the good parts of that analogy, how requester pays essentially is working when it does in the FOIA system, and incorporating some of those ideas into our civil justice discovery.
Let's take another call now. We've got two questions pending. Let's try and get through both of these questions. Go ahead, caller.
Well, if we could just assure perfect justice and judgments, then loser pays would be an excellent system. And the physical costs in the 80s used to be you load up a couple of tractor trailers and drive the files to a couple of hotel rooms that you rent for the purpose. So it was huge compared to what it is in electronics. But one of the tools for reducing costs, since so much cost in a big case, is the discovery of profits or the extent of the damages. If you can bifurcate the case, there's no need to litigate the issue of what the damages are, which can be the biggest part of discovery, until you've determined if there's liability. So bifurcation should probably be used more often to reduce costs.
What about that? That's an interesting point.
Yeah, this is Professor Spencer. That's one of the points that I didn't get to in my opening remarks in terms of the proposals that I would suggest. And that was phased discovery. Instead of just once we get through the pleading stage, no holds barred, all discovery of all issues in the case are on the table. Judges currently under the rules have the ability to phase discovery and focus on the key issues in the case and threshold issues that might obviate the need to go to further discovery. And so I think one of the themes throughout all of this is that judges have the tools in the rules now to do everything they need to do to control discovery costs and to cabin discovery within proper boundaries. And part of the problem is, unfortunately, that many, I dare say most, judges either don't have the time or the inclination to use those tools. And so I don't know if it requires further judicial education or some admonition or maybe something on the nomination and appointments front, although these issues don't typically take center stage when you're dealing with judicial appointments. But these tools are there, and so bifurcating or phasing discovery is definitely something that all judges should be doing to reduce the cost of discovery.
Should the plaintiffs and the defendants be using more motions to encourage judges to do that?
I would encourage that. It should be part of the discovery plan that the parties agree to. When they present that to the judge, they say, Judge, I think we should have phased discovery. This is the critical issue in the case. We need to deal with this first, and there shouldn't be any discovery on anything else until we do that. Now, plaintiffs may disagree, but then the judge can make the call when they issue the scheduling order and come down in favor of phased discovery when it makes sense.
Mr. Dahl, were you going to say something on this point?
Yeah, I agree, and I think that the 2015 amendments will have the effect of encouraging more, however you want to call it, phased or bifurcated discovery. And the only thing I'd add to Professor Spencer's comment that it gives judges the tools, I think that the 2015 amendments also give lawyers the tools to bring these things to the attention of judges. I mean, for example, that you have to have the in-person conference means that you have the ability to get to the point to the judge. Hopefully you have a receptive judge, and that's not always going to be the case. But there's some pretty good things being written about how the new amendments give lawyers a number of different ways to ask judges to use these powers in a sensible way. And it all comes back really to the proportionality test and that the discovery has to be relevant to the claims and defenses in the case, and that's kind of the starting point of, you know, let's tackle this issue first and see where it leads and come back for more if we need to.
We are out of our budgeted time with one question pending. Our experts have agreed they can stand here a minute or two longer, so let's take now our final question.
Hi, I'll try and keep this as briefly as possible. At the very beginning of the call, Professor, you had mentioned that there was some sort of frivolous constitutional argument about this, and I was trying to think of what that might be. I was wondering if you could just briefly talk about that. I can't think of what it might actually be.
If you look at, there's an article that was written about this, and then in some of the comments before, I think it was Congress, or they might have been comments to the Rules Committee, were claims that requiring the producer pays was a violation of due process because it constituted a deprivation without due process of law. And we don't really have time to go into that. I've written an article about this. It's in the Review of Litigation that you can look up. But when you look at the Supreme Court's case law on what constitutes a constitutionally cognizable deprivation, having to bear expense associated with producing evidence in a judicial proceeding has been consistently rejected as a deprivation. And additionally, to the extent there is a deprivation, which would be the requirement to either provide irrelevant information or unduly burdensome discovery, we do have a constitutionally sufficient process that precedes the requirement for the producer to pay, which is that the judge can hear a motion for a protective order and evaluate the relevance and the burden of the production. And if there's a judicial determination prior to the imposition of the burden that it's relevant and is proportional, that at that point the constitutional argument completely evaporates because you've had a pre-deprivation hearing that's constitutionally sufficient by an independent judicial decision maker. And so I'll just leave it at that. But I've written extensively about that in that piece that I mentioned.
Well, gentlemen, as I mentioned, we're out of our budgeted time. I want to thank you both. This has been a very interesting discussion. Thank you also to the audience, very engaged today. Thank you for dialing in, and thank you for your questions. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled Teleform conference call tomorrow at noon Eastern at this same number. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.